It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Currently, the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act allows 12 weeks of unpaid leave to Americans who have worked at least 1 year at a business with 50 employees or more. This week, the State Senate Labor and Industry Committee held a public hearing on a proposal to create a paid leave program for Pennsylvania workers. I spoke with the committee chair, Republican Senator Camara Bartolotta, yesterday and asked her what she took away from that hearing.
Well, as the chair of the committee, my responsibility is to take a look at the bills coming across the desk and offer up hearings so that the makers of the bills can have the stakeholders come and testify and answer questions. I haven't made my decision one way or another as to how I'll vote on the legislation, because right now it isn't really even fully cooked, if you will. We did get a lot of information on both sides of the issue from some very knowledgeable and professional stakeholders. And as you just said, the Federal Family Medical Leave Act is available to some employees. The difference is the federal version is unpaid, and it's a lot more restrictive than the proposed legislation for the state level, because this one would be a paid Family Leave Act.
How would that be funded here in Pennsylvania under the current proposal?
It would be an employee contribution, so it would not be something coming from the employers or the business owners. This is employee contribution, and at the moment, the number they proposed was a 0.588%, and that would be something that would come out of each individual employee's paycheck and go into a fund, if you will, that would be statewide and used for individuals for paid family leave.
How do you respond to criticisms from some small independent businesses that they say, although they're not directly kicking into the emergency fund, it'll still cost them money to train replacement workers?
Again, we did hear from a lot of those folks. And the other side of that coin is, if you have someone who has to take 12 to 20 weeks because they've had a serious car accident, or they're going through chemotherapy, or they have a loved one who was is seriously ill and needs their attention, that person would not be at work anyway. So training would have to go on if that person needs to be replaced during that time period. The business owner would have to train someone for that position anyway. You don't want people who are, through no fault of their own, find themselves unable to go to work, and then they lose their home, they lose their car, they lose their ability to get back to work when they're well. And the consequences are even worse for new moms who would like to spend some time with their brand new babies or even an adoptive baby.
This is a tax on workers. Do you think it might be the best use of the revenue generated, though?
That was a great question that was proposed by some folks. And the calculation at this particular rate is equivalent to roughly a 19% increase in the personal income tax. This is the period of time when we bring everybody to the table and they put out all of their concerns on both sides, and we just see where we can change language of the bill, where we can address concerns, and see what's palatable to the members of the committee.
Senator, you said you have not made up your mind as of yet. What do you need to hear to learn to make a decision one way or the other?
Well, I've got some concerns when it comes to administering the benefits of the program and the ability for the labor and industry department to actually, administer the program, keep track of it, and be able to deal with it. I mean, they had some struggles with modernizing the unemployment comps benefits. The computer system was a nightmare. So this would effectively be about almost a $2 billion program. It's a lot of money to handle and administer, and are we ready to do that? Do we have the capability? Those are all questions that are out there.
That was Senator Camara Bartolotta, chair of the Senate Labor and Industry Committee, on the line from Harrisburg yesterday. We're going to continue our discussion about proposed paid family leave in Pennsylvania with Heather Arnay, CEO of the Women and Girls Foundation. She joins us in studio. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
You were at the committee hearing this week in Harrisburg. What was your assessment of what you heard?
Well, first of all, you just played a segment from Senator Bartolotta, and she's been a really wonderful champion for this issue and for this region. I had the honor of going to meet with her in December with several of her constituents, a small business owner, and Josie Badger, a huge advocate for disability rights in our region. Several of your listeners might know Josie, and as I said, a couple of business owners. And, you know, Senator Bartolotta has been very thoughtful on this issue, and I really appreciate that she decided to have the hearing. You know, it's hearings don't just happen in Harrisburg. They require the leadership of chairs of those committees and, of course, the sponsorship of the senators themselves. And, of course, Senator Laughlin and Senator Collette, who sponsored the legislation. So, you know, at the hearing, what was really striking is during a time when, you know, our country can be quite polarized right now, I think, from a partisan standpoint, this is a piece of legislation that has so much strong bipartisan support, bicameral support. It's a piece of legislation that's supported by Republicans and Democrats, people from different sides of the state. And you really saw that in the room. The room was filled, and it was filled with advocates, and it was filled with business owners, and the people who spoke on behalf of the legislation. The panel that was for the legislation had veterans, small business owners, someone from an insurance agency, someone from pediatric palliative care, and AARP. So it was a really diverse panel speaking on behalf of the legislation.
Variations of paid family leave have been floated before. Is this the furthest that the idea has advanced in the legislature?
It is. This piece of legislation is modeled on best practices that are now in place in 9 other states. And I think this is absolutely why this is the farthest this issue has gotten. This legislation is based on this new model, a paid family and medical leave insurance fund established by citizens, by workers across a state. And all of our East Coast neighbors now have this model in place. New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., Rhode Island. We're basically the only East Coast state that doesn't have it in place anymore. And so I think this is why the model has gotten so far, why this piece of legislation is now being seriously considered by our Department of Labor and the Labor and Industry Committee.
Briefly, give us an idea of who might benefit from the paid family leave.
All workers in Pennsylvania and all employers in Pennsylvania.
Specifically, though.
Yeah. Especially small businesses are going to benefit. So, you know, we all hear about the Googles and the Facebooks offering, you know, 6 months, a year of paid leave because they're trying to attract the best talent, right? You know, we all need paid family and medical leave because at some time in our lives, we're going to need care or we're going to need to care for someone. Our state has one of the oldest populations in the country. Our fastest growing demographic are octogenarians, right? Mm-hmm. And we all want to be able to care for our elders. Family needs to be able to care for family. When we hear paid family and medical leave, often we think about infants. And of course, it's an important issue because infant mortality and maternal mortality are really at a high crisis rate in our state, especially for women of color. So yes, it's important to be able to take paid family and medical leave to take care of a new child when they enter your life. But in our state, this issue polls so high, over 75% across age, across party, across gender, across the state geographically. But when you tell folks that it covers elder care, that shoots to 81%.
But does that change with who's paying for it? Because this proposal is a payroll deduction on the employees. Does that support Wayne, though, when it comes up? Who's going to foot the bill?
No, it doesn't. And it's because of what I just said. Mm-hmm. Because all of us know that we're human. And that means that we're all going to age. We might get sick. We might get in an accident. We might, God forbid, get an illness or have cancer or have something that we need to take time off for. And we might have a spouse. We might have a child. We might have a parent who needs care. And because of that, right now in this country, only 14% of workers have access to even one day of paid leave, but 100% of workers need it. Only 6% of service workers have access to paid leave, but 100% of them need it. And that's why when you do the polling, folks say, yes, I'm willing to pay a tiny bit, half a penny on the dollar to make sure that when I need it, it'll be there. Because the number one thing we hear from folks about what happens when they don't have paid leave, the number one thing, Kevin, Bankruptcy.
House be because it costs out of their pocket, loss of
they
wages.
They lose their job, they lose their wages. Nobody should have to fall into bankruptcy, lose their homes, lose their jobs because they had a new child or because their mother broke their hip or because their spouse had to go through chemotherapy, right? Nobody should lose their job, lose their home, lose their income because they got sick or there's someone in their family got sick or because they welcomed a new child into their life.
We have just 90 seconds left. What do you see as key stumbling blocks, though, to passage?
I think what's key at this point is that folks like Senator Bartolotta and the other members of the House and Senate in our state, they need to hear from people. They need to hear from the folks across the state who need this so badly. That's how this legislation's gotten this far. Folks can go to familycareact.com to learn more information. They can text FAMILY to 52886 in order to learn more information. A lot of us are on our smartphones more than our computers. The folks in the legislature need to learn from hear from folks. That's who this is going to impact the most is families and workers and people in Pennsylvania. And that's who the legislators need to hear from.
In a couple sentences, in Washington this week, the U.S. House was debating three different proposals for paid family leave. Which might be the quicker path to paid leave, federal or state action?
State, absolutely. That's why we've seen these nine states, and I'm confident in Pennsylvania. I believe in Pennsylvanians, I believe in Pennsylvania's legislature, and I believe in Pennsylvania's small businesses. That's who drives the state's economy. And I see small businesses every day trying to compete with larger businesses, and larger businesses are offering these kinds of benefits because they can afford it. Small business owners can't afford to offer them. That's why the state insurance fund can be such a benefit to small business owners. The business owners don't have to pay into the insurance fund, but their employees will now have this access to an incredible benefit, and it'll really put small business owners on a level playing field.
Heather Arne is the CEO of the Women and Girls Foundation. Heather, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, UPMC is exploring the start of a new subsidiary. Plus, a Fayette County-based program is teaching Western Pennsylvania grade schoolers practical life skills on the realistic set of a brand new town. And later, the state is loaning the PWSA $65 million to help the authority replace aging water pipes in Pittsburgh. Where exactly is this money going, and how might the authority pay it back? You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
The Beatles played their last real concert in 1966 when they decided it was in their best interest to make music only in the studio. By the end of the decade, the Fab Four had released a string of legendary albums, but they weren't getting along so well personally, and tensions ran high during the Let It Be sessions. Though no one's exactly sure who had the idea to perform on the roof of Apple Records, everyone, including keyboardist Billy Preston, agreed to give it a shot. The Beatles made their final public performance on this day in 1969, though it ended abruptly after police responded to the many noise complaints and shut it down. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
The 2010s didn't end well for air quality in Pittsburgh. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Last December saw six of the most unhealthy air days the region has experienced in recent memory. Oliver Morrison, the environment and health reporter at PublicSource.org, talked to county leaders about what it will take to improve air quality.
Air pollution is trending downward across Allegheny County, but in 2019, that trend was disrupted, first by two fires at the Clairton Coke Works, and then two extreme temperature inversions. That's when warmer air lays on top of cooler air and traps the air pollution. The inversion during the week of Christmas caused high levels of air pollution across the county. Jim Kelly, the county's deputy director of environmental health, says they will get worse with climate change.
A strong inversion, say, starts around 5 degrees difference. We were reading 12 and 13. That's exceptionally strong.
Air quality advocates say the health department should have been prepared for an event like this.
Show us that you take your name, the Allegheny County Health Department, seriously. Thank you.
That's Mark Dixon, an air quality activist, outside the city-county building earlier this month. He and around 100 other protesters expressed outrage over the holiday pollution. Kelly spoke directly to the protesters' concerns at a Department of Health board meeting later.
You know, I recognize the efforts in the rally today, and I see your signs, you know, clean air now. Clean air doesn't happen now. It doesn't happen immediately.
He says it takes a while to write new regulations, wait for the fixes, check for compliance, take corrective actions, and then, eventually, the air quality improves. Kelly says the health department doesn't have the resources to both tackle unexpected events and fully address everyday pollution. So he's had to shift staff around. That means one of his priorities hasn't happened. The department was supposed to set stricter regulations on emissions that escape from coke ovens in Clairton. This would help reduce hydrogen sulfide emissions that make the air smell like rotten eggs. Rachel Filippini, the executive director for the Group Against Smog and Pollution, wants to know when she can expect action.
Look, the air quality program made a commitment of May of 2018. Here it is, January 2020. I've seen no progress on this. How patient are we supposed to be?
Filippini says the county's air quality improvements have not been felt equally. The air in the Mon Valley is among the unhealthiest in the country. That feels unfair to Art Thomas, a Clairton resident for 70 years. His wife has cancer that he blames on air pollution. He told the Board of Health at their January meeting that its steady progress is still leaving residents like him behind.
Clairton Mills out here killing people, and I'm actually talking about killing people. And don't nobody say nothing to them.
But Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald says the county is spending more money on air quality than ever before.
Ultimately, do you feel like it is the county executive's role to just take full responsibility for what happens?
Well, if I could, but they've got there's processes in place. So we've created a government that has a board of health, that has a county council. So any regulations or enforcement that is done needs to go through a process.
The health department is hiring several new staff. Within the next year, Kelly says, the department will update its regulations to address the new weather patterns brought by climate change. And eventually, Kelly says, the county will make its coke oven regulations more stringent, but it will take time.
We're in motion now, and I want to say that we're picking up speed.
For the Allegheny Front and PublicSource.org, I'm Oliver Morrison.
And PublicSource.org is a news partner of the Allegheny Front. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapel.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Every so often on this program, I and the producers get to leave the studio and go meet people in our community in person. My colleague Megan Harris was on just such a mission yesterday when she met Gene Cunicelli of UPMC Enterprises at its Bakery Square offices. They plan to talk about UPMC's new $1 billion in investment money, and they did. But Megan, I understand you also talked about something else.
Yeah, Cunicelli talked about this concept called UPMC Pharma. I think that was just a name she pulled off the cuff. But it was this idea of starting a pharmaceutical company in Pittsburgh with Pittsburgh people. And it sounds like it's going to be a pretty expensive venture.
The money that we're discussing, it's no longer in the tens of millions. It may be higher in terms of what we need to put to work to build that company. But the vision for that would be a sustainable, long-term, big presence in Pittsburgh type of company with lots of employees and people we recruit.
And she's pretty hopeful about that recruiting piece. Cunicelli herself was a Carnegie Mellon grad. She was working at a venture capital firm in San Francisco when she was recruited to come back to Pittsburgh. She said lots of people are already coming for tech jobs and pharma could just be an extension of that.
So UPMC Pharma, do we know what that will mean? What kind of drugs?
Not what kinds of drugs, that remains to be seen, but it will be a very considered part of their $1 billion investment strategy. It could mean acquiring a company with an established product first, and then they'll, well, we'll hear it from Cunicelli.
Get that up and running and then marry it with the earlier stage assets so that as its revenue assets mature, you have the ideas that can keep bringing new products to market.
So by assets, I think she's talking about some research and development opportunities. Mm-hmm. So they might invest in a product that's in the earliest stages of what they hope it will be and maybe a product that's, you know, several years down the line. The process to get a drug to market is incredibly long, years long, let alone to actually get it to a consumer.
Get that up and running. So is there a timeline for this UPMC Pharma?
Cunicelli said that first piece, like finding a company or a product that they could do that initial acquisition on, they would like to have it within a year and a half or 2 years and maybe build from there. Again, that biggest piece, though, would be coupling that then with research and development. Mm-hmm.
Pharmaceuticals, that sounds like for-profit. UPMC is a nonprofit. How does that work?
Yeah, it's kind of a confusing distinction for a lot of us. The health plan, for example, is for-profit, and enterprises has been the commercialization arm of the organization for years. When they're successful, it's because something is profiting, so which by their definition means that they can then pump that revenue back into other ventures. In the announcement January 14th of the $1 billion, for example, they self-reported that their previous $800 million has returned $1.5 billion. Now, that portfolio is very different than what they're going to be pursuing in the future with drugs. It's going to be so much riskier. It takes a long time to develop, but returns like that make them feel really good going into the future.
So why now, if pharmaceuticals are on the menu, why didn't they announce it when they made public the $1 billion in venture capital?
Kind of hard to say. It sounds like this plan is still very much in its infancy. But that said, it's been in discussion for a while. Cunicelli was very clear that this possibility was a big reason why she came to Pittsburgh in the first place. And she's already got a team in place of executives, industry experts, looking at potential assets, potential products, and hopefully finding some more in the future.
Megan Harris is the editor and producer of The Confluence. You can hear her full conversation with Jean Cunicelli of UPMC Enterprises on this program next week. Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you. And you can check us online at WESA.FM for more.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Educators often say they want to prepare young people to be globally competitive. But what about dealing with challenges, tasks of everyday life? Junior Achievement has been aiming to meld those two for the last 80 years. This week, they celebrated the launch of a new program to achieve that goal. Dennis Guilfoyle is the president and CEO of Junior Achievement of Western Pennsylvania, and Fran Serenka is the program director of Education Administration and Supervision at Duquesne University. Welcome to The Confluence, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis, for those unfamiliar, your programming, it's geared to students at what grade levels? Where are we starting?
We start as early as kindergarten. So we are a sequential curriculum, K-12, really focused on one of three areas, entrepreneurship, financial management, or workforce.
Right. And what they learn ranges from really some of the basics, right, from saving and spending on up to what you just mentioned.
Absolutely. Especially in the elementary programs, we kind of simple concepts initially, like in kindergarten, you're not teaching economic theory. You're talking about the idea of paying yourself first. You want to get something. You want to buy something. But how do you do that? You know, so you save money bit by bit by doing odd jobs around the house, helping, chores, et cetera, and that you put it in a piggy bank, and then ultimately you can go buy that item that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. In the third grade, we teach youngsters how to write a check and open a bank account for the very first time. So as they get older in age and grade, we kind of expand on the concepts and really kind of build one upon the other. And so when they get into high school, we do get a little bit more deeper, obviously, in the subject content area.
So who's building? Who's working with the kids?
That's the cool part. Our secret sauce, as they say, I'm going to reveal it to all of your audience today. The secret sauce that Junior Achievement has are 3,000 volunteers, 3,000 in Western Pennsylvania.
Are they professionals? What are they?
No. Some of them are Franny students at Duquesne University. Some are business people, certainly, parent volunteers, et cetera. Some retirees, other organizations that adopt schools for us and will have their volunteer employees, whatever, go in. We train everybody, provide all the hands-on materials, get them ready, and then in the classrooms they go. And they share their life's experiences and Junior Achievement's curriculum to make the learning become active and more experiential than just reading a textbook or right. Watching a video.
Fran, you are a graduate of the JA experience. How did it help you beyond what you were getting out of your regular school classes?
Well, in those days, we went down to the Boulevard of the Allies because there was a building down there, which was the JA building. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing we learned I was 14 years old when I took my first lesson with JA, and we were creating products all the way from the concept design through the raw materials and financing. So that was an exciting experience. We did, one year I did hangers, and the other year I did baking pans. And then we would sell them for a return profit. So it was a very, very good experience. And I think what I learned mostly is that there's an entrepreneurial spirit in everyone, and that each and every person can really define what their success will be going forward. And that was years ago.
To both of you, how do you connect the dots between what's learned in school and how it's applied to everyday life? Fran, we'll start with you.
What's learned in school, the Department of Education lays out specific guidelines for career readiness. And we have to address each one of those as we go along, and JA does exactly that. JA is mentioned in the guidelines for career readiness.
Mm-hmm. Dennis?
It's interesting. You go in and you'll hear, what's your favorite subject in school? And they may say anything from, you know, from language arts to math to science. And so then what you do then as a JA volunteer, connect that subject to career.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How would you rate the financial literacy of the students you meet these days?
Oh, mercy.
There's a lot to learn, and I think that the more business people our students are working with, the more they will understand the use of their money.
All right, Dennis, can they handle the everyday basics? Have those basics changed through the years?
Well, you know, it goes the bigger picture we look at is all these statistics you read about, you know, people, American people, you know, two-thirds of them are living paycheck to paycheck. We survey and poll our young people all the time, and two-thirds of our kids think they're going to be still living at home in their 30s right now. That's scary. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do, again, we're trying to tell them the importance of planning and what money is for. It's certainly credit, and we get into all those issues to help them, again, try to steer away from the typical track that I'm going to go straight to college, I'm going to borrow a lot of money, and then I'm going to come out of school, and I'm going to have a really big job, and I'm going to be able to pay off my loans, and then the reality of that is very slim. It really is. College debt is a problem in this country. It's certainly high in Pennsylvania. Last year, the college graduating class of 2019, 58% of them are underemployed, meaning that they can't find the job in their chosen profession. Right. That's scary.
Our guests on The Confluence are Fran Cerenka, Program Director of Education Administration at Duquesne University, and Dennis Guilfoyle, CEO of Junior Achievement. Tuesday, you cut the ribbon on what you build as Pennsylvania's newest town, JA BizTown. Tell us what it looks like.
Well, when you walk in, your first impression may be, this looks like a mall. And then you're going to do a double take and go, not really, because the way that the stores are designed, they are companies that we know and use in everyday life, like a Giant Eagle, like a Number One Cochrane, like a Highmark, FedEx Ground. But they are literally replicas of their buildings, for the most part, that you see traveling around the Western Pennsylvania landscape. And so there are 20 of these, 19 of which are sponsored. The 20th is City Hall, so we have a form of government.
Right.
And then they are conducting commerce. These are young people starting in grades 4, 5, and 6 that have been prepared at school over the course of about 10 sessions to come to BizTown and run the city.
But it's an interactive simulation, correct?
It is, but to them it's the real deal. I mean, it's amazing. When we had the students there, watching them write a check for the very first time, or taking their paycheck. They got paid twice, right? So the first time they get their paycheck, a third of them get a break. They run down to the bank, which our bank is Clearview Federal Credit Union, and they stand in line. And they wait to visit a teller, and they make a deposit, and they open a checking account, and they get cash, a checkbook, and a debit card that actually works in business, in BizTown. It's really cool.
So the kids are buying into the theater of it, if you would?
Oh, they certainly are. And so then each business of these 19 have to conduct some sort of commerce. For example, Coppers, you know, which is a leading industrial manufacturer here in Pittsburgh. The kids, the employees, the citizens of Coppers and BizTown made and sold slime. Very cool slime, in fact. They took it home with them.
I understand it's for 4th to 6th graders.
Yep.
Why is it so important to engage kids early on to get them to think about their future?
It's important to think about the future because each one of the students, every child I know, dreams about what they're going to do when they grow up. we really have to introduce them to a wide variety of things to do when they grow up. Because many students, there's some, you know, young children who want to be professional sports players. But the reality is they're going to have to really earn a living, and Junior Achievement does exactly that. And through BizTown, they're able to take their knowledge and connect it to doing.
We're talking about 10 to 12-year-olds approximately. Right. How did you keep it fun so that they might continue to be engaged?
Sure. There is so much activity that goes on at BizTown, they don't have much time to kind of rest and break. So when they arrive, they assemble at Town Square, and so we make a morning announcement that BizTown has officially been opened. And every CEO, there's a CEO for every company, and that's been predetermined at school because they've interviewed for the jobs. The CEO gets up and gives an address. Hi, I'm Little right. John. I'm going to be the CEO of FedEx Ground, and today we're going to teach you how do we deliver packages safely. And you know, and so they all did their little speeches, and then they went to their respective businesses. And the first thing the CEO did is grabbed his or her CFO, the chief financial officer, and said, "Hey, get down to the bank. We need to borrow $200 to open business." And that's how it really works in the real world. So we went down and got his loan from the or their loan from the bank, came back. Then they went to Ace Hardware to buy supplies, or they went to FedEx Ground to get those delivered. If something had to be built, we had Mascaro Construction Corporation, so you had to go there. So it was constant activity going on. We have our radio station, and they went down to the radio station, and they made a request. You pay to do that, right? So, because the on-air announcers were two students, and they had a sales executive who was going around because they were selling commercial time, right? And so it's nonstop. So by the time 2 o'clock rolls around, these kids are spent. I mean, they were so happy, so excited to be there, and they thought they had a great day, at least as they were leaving. I said, "Would you want to come back?" "Oh, absolutely. Can we come back tomorrow?" You know, so it was engaged and active, an experience, just not learning. You know what I mean? They're involved in something all day long.
Pat, how many schools do you expect to benefit from this, and in what region?
Right now, on our schedule for the second semester that we opened, we have about 3,000 students that are signed up. That is about 40 schools.
Mm-hmm.
Our territory, and why we located where we're at, we're at South Fayette Township in the Abilene Business Park. We're a mile from the Interstate 79 exit, is because we serve from Parkersburg, West Virginia, up to Erie, Pennsylvania, over to State College, Altoona, Johnstown, and back. So we have schools right now on the schedule coming right now from as far away as Meadville. That's like 100 miles. Mm-hmm. They want to participate. And again, the preparatory work happens at the classroom during the regular school day. So they're all prepared when they walk in to start the day.
Final question to both of you. Whether it's JA BizTown or something else, what's it going to take to ready our kids for the expected tens of thousands of job openings that are anticipated over the next decade? Fran, let's start with you.
Well, it's certainly going to take a lot of energy on their part. It's important for all of our students to know exactly what they want to do for their future. And I think that it takes an entire community, mentors, apprenticeships, people who are willing to offer internships, and good preparation like Junior Achievement through BizTown to connect our students and point them in the right direction.
And Dennis, are you concerned about any sort of skills gap or even personnel gap?
Well, we are. That's why we're doing BizTown. It was really when the Allegheny Conference came out with its report, this was our response. There's 125 jobs in BizTown, and every one of those 19 employers that put money invested into their store in BizTown, we sat down with and said, what are the jobs that you're going to feel like you're going to be short on in the next generation?
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, there were a lot of skilled labor, a lot of technical jobs. And so we wanted to reflect that in the jobs that are at BizTown. So we negotiated that with each and every business. So when the kids come in, they're seeing the jobs of the future, the jobs that are waiting here for them now. And again, we hope that at least inspires them to look at the different opportunities. Again, back to this, you don't necessarily have to go to a four-year college. But you can go and work at Mascaro Corporation. You can go be a welder. You can be an assembler, where you're perhaps going to technical school. You get a two-year degree or go to community college and come out and get a sustainable job. This is our answer to the workforce issues of today and tomorrow and the next generation.
Dennis Guilfoyle is the president and CEO of Junior Achievement of Western Pennsylvania. Fran Cerenka is the program director of education administration and supervision at Duquesne University. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority has received a $65 million state loan for infrastructure improvements. Will Pickering is the deputy executive director of PWSA. Will, how will this loan help the agency toward its ongoing efforts to replace lead lines?
Well, this low-interest loan is going to help us do a number of things. It's going to help us replace our water mains that we know we need to increase the rate of replacement. And while we're replacing those water mains, we're going to replace the lead service lines that might be attached to them. So it's really expanding the level of work that we're doing, helping us renew our infrastructure, and doing that at a low borrowing cost, which is really great for our customers and great for our organization.
So 80,000 feet of water main, what does that really mean?
We're talking about 15 miles of water main across the city. So these will be a couple blocks at a time. We've prioritized where we're replacing these mains based on the age of the mains, whether they're more likely to have lead service lines attached to them. We're also looking at demographic information about where there's likely to be children, and those are the neighborhoods that we're most concerned about exposure to lead. So all of that went into a series of data that we were looking at and where we're prioritizing this work for this upcoming construction season.
Where are some of those priority neighborhoods or locations?
They're throughout the city. I don't have the individual blocks in front of me, but the idea is that we are trying to spread this investment across our service area and, again, prioritizing the mains that need the most love and attention first.
Okay. The money is also going to be used, as you alluded to replace private lines. Those are the ones from the curb to the home?
That's right. So we divide up our ownership of what we call the service lines, which is the small diameter pipe from a water main into a home between the public side, which is from the main to the curb. Curb into the home is typically the responsibility of the homeowner. But if there's a lead line there, our commitment is that we replace that entire line at no cost to the customer. And that's what we're going to be doing with this funding.
But you stop, though, at that connection inside the house. You don't go and replace plumbing in case there are older pipes within the home itself.
That's a great point, Kevin. Sometimes there are components of lead like solder and segments of lead pipe that are within the home that are the homeowner's responsibility to replace.
This is a loan, not a grant. So how does that affect PWSA's overall debt?
Well, we're really lucky to get this investment from the state because it's a 1% loan. And if we went to the municipal bond market, which is typically how we fund our infrastructure improvements, we'd be paying close to 3%. So that savings is actually over time going to save our ratepayers $20 million over the next 20 years. Mm-hmm.
Orders from the DEP to replace the lead lines came after testing that showed PWSA water was exceeding maximum federal levels for lead. The agency started adding a chemical last year, orthophosphate, to prevent the lead from in the pipes from sort of leaching into the water itself. How's that helped?
Well, we've seen the lead levels trend downward. We saw progress almost immediately when we started adding orthophosphate in April. And like you alluded to, this is an additive that's used in cities, older cities across the country, that provides a coating inside that lead pipe that prevents corrosion. And we expect lead levels to continue downward. The last two rounds have shown a lot of progress. We have a lot of data to support that it's effective. And we expect that progress to continue as the orthophosphate continues to permeate through our system.
So on your progress report, as far as replacement, how far along are you of replacing lead lines?
Since 2016, about halfway through 2016 is when we embarked on this, we've replaced over 6,000 lines. And the total number is something that we're not going to know for certain, but we've estimated around 12,000 service lines or so. So we've made a huge dent in the total inventory. But we're going to continue to keep our foot on the gas pedal and keep replacing those lines until they're all out of our system.
All right. A 1% loan is still a loan. How do you plan on paying that back? Is it going to involve rate hikes on customers?
That's a great question. The investment is coming from our ratepayers. And as we're more productive and catching up with decades of a period where we weren't investing in our system, we're going to ask for more contributions from our ratepayers. But the concept here with a loan is that we spread that cost over time. So it's not a lump sum spike in rates. It's something that we spread out as we benefit from these improvements over time.
Will Pickering is the Deputy Executive Director for Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Will, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here, Kevin. Thanks.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.